Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Stargazing with Star Fuentes. Star Fuentes is a master intuitive healer and spiritual teacher and has been a pioneering student of metaphysics for over 50 years. She has learned lifetimes of priceless information from her years of seeking out and living with indigenous healers and shamans around the world. Visit her website at www.starfuentes.com and then join her here every Wednesday night on Spiritual Connections Radio as she shares her knowledge with you. And now, Star Fuentes.
Welcome. After the half hour, we will be taking callers. The number is 646-716-9663. And tonight I'm very pleased to have with me Alan Hunter. Hi, Alan.
Hi, Star. Thank you so much for inviting me onto your show. It's a great privilege.
You're welcome. Now, I see on your website, alanhunter.net, that you have a really nice bio. What it doesn't tell me is how you got started spiritually and what sparked that moment for you to start on your spiritual path.
Well, you know, that's a wonderful question because one of the things about getting started on spiritual paths, and I'm sure this is true for most of your listeners, is that we only sometimes look back on events after a period of time and say, oh, it looks as though my whole outlook has changed. Certainly that was the case for me, and I suspect for many of us, there aren't many people who suddenly wake up and go, I see the world differently. There is usually an event, but it takes us a while to process it. And so that is really what I describe in my book, Gratitude and Beyond, because what happened to me was an occasion of healing, you might say. It was an occasion of physical breakdown, physical healing, but also in the process of that physical and extensive crisis, what changed was my entire way of looking at the world. So you might say, that was when I realized I was already on a path. And it kept nudging me forward, but I wrote this book, Gratitude and Beyond, almost 20 years after the event, because it occurred to me, this was a big event. I know it's a big event, and I haven't ever shared it with anyone, really. It was too good for me to keep to myself. So if I can just go into some detail, if that's okay.
Go ahead.
Thank you. What happened to me was that I was living in England. That's why I've got this funny accent. You know, I lived the first part of my life in England, first 30 years. And I was working in an extremely difficult job with disturbed adolescents in a residential community, a very demanding job. And the trouble was that I thought in my way that I could be everything to everybody. I thought that I could be a good therapist with these very disturbed young people. I thought that I could make my then fiance's life happy, which really wasn't my job. I thought that I could make the world a better place. I thought I could please my parents, who are still looking down their noses at me a little bit and saying, what's he doing in this line of work? I thought that I had to prove everything to everybody. And that, I really do believe, is what caused me to become physically sick. And the symptoms of my sickness were, guess what? You know, I was unable to breathe. So I went in the way that one does in England. You go to the National Health Service and you say to the doctor, doctor, I can't breathe. I can't walk more than a few yards without leaning up against something to take a breath. And the doctor, God bless him, said, yes, you've got adult onset asthma. Here's an inhaler. You'll never get clear of this. You'll have to use an inhaler for the rest of your life. So I thanked him, took this thing, and went off, and I didn't get better. In fact, I got worse. I got worse and worse. He kept giving me more and more powerful steroid inhalers. and shaking his head. And eventually, in despair, I did something that in those days was very daring. Remember, we're talking about the 1980s here. I went to an acupuncture and holistic healing center just outside London. Still there, going strong, wonderful people. And when I walked in, I thought, oh, aren't these people nice? They've given me a comfy chair and a cup of tea and all this. And what I didn't realize, because they didn't tell me at the time, I didn't realize until 3 weeks later, was they said, oh, well, when you came in, you were turning blue from lack of oxygen. So we thought you were just about to die. But the dear lady said, well, you know, we did have one person who was as sick as you, but he survived too. And it was then that I realized that I had come very, very close to ceasing to breathe, because I was metaphorically and metaphysically drowning. Now, these wonderful people at the acupuncture clinic, to whom my gratitude is daily, part of my living, they set me right in a matter of weeks. And it wasn't just a physical setting right, although they did very well to relax my body so that it could begin to heal itself. And this is what I didn't realize until later. And as I began to breathe again, I was able to look at my life and say, you know, I think I'm caught up in this ego swirl of trying to be everything to everybody, and it can't be done. I don't want to do that anymore. And so I took a very bold move. I got well enough to go back to work, discovered that, yes, it was every bit as bad as I thought in terms of me not being a good match for it. And I resigned from my job. And at that point, that meant I would have no pay, no home, because the house I was living in came with the job. My wife didn't have a job. Well, she was my wife by then. And we said, well, everything has changed, hasn't it? And that's when I came to the United States looking for work. Now, looking back at that, 20-odd years later, I was able to say, what was it that happened to me? Can I pin it down? And what happened was a complete new way of looking at what had been a very mechanistic world, a five-sensory world. And I began to realize that healing is a spiritual activity as well as a physical activity of taking the right tablets and eating the right things and exercising the right way. And the more time I've spent in that space over these, well, it's nearly 30 years now, the more time I've spent in that space, the more time I've realized, talking to people, asking them about things, that healing is immensely complicated, and yet it's only complicated in the number of ways it happens. But at the basis, it has to do with healing our souls. Otherwise, our bodies are really not going to heal. So, Star, that's a very long response to a short question. But
you're doing a great job at it. And your book, Gratitude and Beyond, is available at Amazon.com?
Yes,
or is it available
yes.
on your site?
Amazon, you can get it from Amazon. You can go to Findhorn Press, my publishers, and get it from their site. You can also write to me, and I will tell you where to send the check or the PayPal payment and get the books that way. So it's readily available.
It's allanhunter.net.
Yes, and I should point out it's A-L-L-A-N Hunter, all one word. Because
and don't
forget
it's net.com.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There is a fellow called Alan Hunter who writes books of film criticism, and I'm sure they're very lovely, but he's not me. So Alan G. Hunter is a good search vehicle if you're going.
I have something I tell my students, and I tell my students the amount you breathe is the amount you participate in life. So you talk about in your latest blog, Breath.
Yeah.
Can you tell us a little bit more how powerful full breath is in the everyday moment and in...
Oh, happily, happily. Any one of your listeners who's ever done yoga will know that there is often a breathing component to the exercises. Not in all types of yoga, but certainly in the more meditative types of yoga. But I think we can step back from that and say that most of us don't know really how to breathe. We just sort of let it happen. And we don't pay attention to it. And we don't feel the ease of breathing in the air, and we don't feel the ease of letting the air out. Now, speaking of someone who had this lung complaint, I'm very conscious of breathing, and perhaps many of us are. But you see, when you breathe, you're not just sort of doing something automatically. You're actually entering an understanding with the universe. You're saying, you know, yes, I'm agreeing to take in this air. Yes, I'm agreeing that it is absolutely vital for my life, and then I'm agreeing to let it out again. That's a wonderful metaphor for the way that we need to move through the world. Some people think that we take stuff in and then we have to sort of hang on to it. And some of those people tend to wind up being over-enthusiastic collectors of items, being hoarders even, because the essential component is to take in and let go. It's take and give. Take it. It's like love. It really is love. It's our love affair with the nature that created us. We can take love, but then we also have to give back, and then more comes to us, and we give back. It is always a reciprocal action. Now, some of my counseling people that I work with, and I've been working with them for a number of years, are suspicious of anything that they have to give back in case they might feel that something's been taken from them. So they're willing to take people's attention, they're willing to take their love, they're willing to try to get money, but they're not willing to let it go. And in doing that, I think we're offending against the fundamental law of the universe that is symbolized to us every moment when we breathe. Now, I've just been graced with a new granddaughter, a second granddaughter, who is wonderful. Of course, you know, she's less than 2 weeks old. But when we are born, the first thing we experience is, we have to take a breath. And from that moment onwards, we're always doing it. And it's a bit like nature is telling us, look, I can supply you with everything you need, but you have to cooperate and breathe in and breathe out, breathe in and breathe out. The way we breathe is likely to indicate how we approach our world. Do we snatch our breaths? Do we find ourselves breathless at the top of a set of stairs? Or can we allow ourselves to be fully in this element which is allowing us to live every day? It's so fundamental, and we all look past it. You talk to any athletic coach, and athletic coaches who are worth anything will say, you know, look at the way this athlete breathes, especially in things like rowing and swimming and running. You know, is this person allowing him or herself to breathe easily, deeply, effectively? And you know what? That's the place to start if you're going to get good results from your body. And I think that's something that's worth remembering.
I agree. And it's so simple. Breathing is so simple that people overlook it and want something with 142 steps with a 1,000-page handout to go with it. And I understand that the mind does complicate things. But just think of the lovely trees out there all taking that carbon dioxide and changing it into oxygen. I see you have written a book called Spiritual Hunger. And I'm not sure that people know when they're hungry or they're creating that spiritual hunger over and over again. So what did you have to share in your book, Spiritual Hunger?
Oh, you ask lovely questions, because it's a perfect match for if you like, the spirituality behind breathing. spiritual hunger, it seems to me, I mean, well, here we are, this is the United States, we are, many of us, overweight, many of us extremely overweight, we eat a lot and we discard a lot. Well, the pleasures of the table are wonderful, but sometimes that hunger, the hunger whether it's for food or possessions or money or power, sometimes that hunger is only there because we do not feel spiritually fulfilled. And so the process that I look at in that book was to say, if we want to feed ourselves nourishing spiritual food, there's plenty around, instead of which many people find themselves feeding themselves on, well, conspiracy theories. Oh, yes, I'll spend a lot of time on conspiracy theories. Is that healthy spiritual food? Probably not. We spend a lot of time getting very, very angry about things that the news tells us. I'm sure we do, because everyone seems to tell me that. And yet, that fulfills a certain type of hunger, and there are news junkies aplenty out there, but is it the healthiest, most spiritual type of food for what we want? So the book, Spiritual Hunger, is literally about, you know, we're all hungry, of course we are. We're all hungry for something. Let's cut to the chase and say, we're hungry for things that give us spiritual value that we can believe in. We're not really hungry for that extra cheeseburger. We're not really hungry for fill in the blank. We're hungry for something that is going to feed our souls. And so I suggest ways that we can, in fact, do that.
Oh, that sounds wonderful. You know, I tell people, turn on CNN and pray for everybody that shows up in 5 minutes, then turn it off. You know,
how do you know
what to pray for? Just turn on CNN, yeah. And you know, to waste your energy looking at 9/11 or looking at all who's against you, and just read a good novel, for goodness sakes. You know, something full of life. We have the classics, and they're so full of life's lessons. But the classics are the classics, and of course, you know, let's spend our time in another way. I think that I know for sure that I'm going to get on Amazon and order that book as soon as the show is over. I would like to talk about another one of your books, and Princess Frogs and Ugly Sisters. I mean, what a great title. What is the contents of this book?
Basically, what I do is I compare the Grimm brothers' original tales, which they collected with great care. They were serious scholars working in the year 1812. They published their first version of them. I compare their tales with what Disney and other media have tended to do with them. Now, I'm not against people enjoying Disney movies. I've enjoyed many of them, of course. We all have, because they're all around us, and I certainly wouldn't begrudge little girls the opportunity to put on, you know, pink dresses and wave wands around. I know this for a fact because I've taught this class and this workshop to many people, and many people say, oh, but we love this Disney movie or that Disney movie. They say, good, you love it, but let's look at what you're loving, because some things we may love, like food that we may love, and may not be exactly good for us. So if we take the most obvious, I start the book with the most obvious example that occurred to me, and that is, once upon a time I was asked to address a room full of women about finding one's soulmate as part of a panel. Wonderful stuff. And before I started, this beautiful young woman said, yeah, you've got to kiss a lot of frogs before you find a prince. And I said, really? I said, have you ever actually read the original tale? And she said, well, no, I mean, you just have to kiss a lot of frogs, right? And I said, no. In the Disney version, frogs and princesses kiss, or variations thereof. But if you go to the Grimm Brothers version, what happens is the frog keeps really annoying the princess and saying, I want to eat at your table, I want to sit on the bench beside you, I want to be in your bed. I mean, think of that. And the princess gets absolutely blazingly angry, picks him up, throws him at the wall to try and kill him. Now, that's different, right? Disney doesn't ever mention that. And that's the point when he turns into a prince. And you think, that's bizarre, except if you look at it as a metaphor, as a spiritual metaphor, which is some men don't grow up until somebody tells them, grow up or I'm pushing you out of here. And that's when they grow up to be princes. And that's what the frog symbolizes in that tale. When the princess gets her personal power and her sense of personal dignity and says, whatever is in my bed, it's not going to be a frog. That's when she gets angry enough to push him out and he says, okay, all right. And he grows up. Now, to me, that describes so many people who have come to me to counseling who have said, well, you know, I really love my boyfriend, but, you know, he doesn't have a job, he doesn't do this, he doesn't do that. And I've said, well, he won't do that unless you say, grow up, be a man, and then you can share my bed. And yet the Disney version, the popular version, says you've got to go around kissing frogs. Well, as I tell people, you know, if you want more reptiles and amphibians in your life, go around kissing frogs. You'll be surrounded by them forever. But if you want a significant other who is going to pull his or her weight, because, you know, it could be whomsoever, whichever sex you like, if you want someone like that, then you have to ask for it. And paradoxically, you know, why does the prince want the princess after she has tried to kill him? Well, he recognizes that she's got some guts. She's worth loving. Who wouldn't love someone with a bit of spirit? Otherwise, she's a doormat. And who could really love a doormat for very long? So that's the basis of Princes, Frogs, and Ugly Sisters. And in it, I look at the various tales, or some of the various tales, that the Grimm brothers carefully compiled and took a great deal of effort to put to their audiences. And each of them has a surprise like that. And each of those surprises is guaranteed, like the classics you just mentioned, is guaranteed to make us think, what the heck's going on here? And in each case, it's a spiritual challenge. It says, look at what's happening and see whether this might in fact be a better solution than the, well, what I call the doormat solution. I teach at a college.
The whole point of maturity, you know, we're so many people walking around in 30, 40, 50, 60-year-old bodies that physically, mentally, emotionally, spiritually have not matured. And they want it their way and, you know, 100 other different things. And our society doesn't actually endorse us maturing. You know, you're gonna have male menopause, and you're gonna go out and buy a red car and get a trophy wife. You know, and we gotta think about coming into our ripeness, because our ripeness is when we can share the most with people. And some people are like a century plant; they bloom every 50 years, and some people never grow up. And many of the fairy tales talk subconsciously about maturing. And to teach someone to mature, you can give them all the facts. You can say, this is maturity, this isn't mature. And yet there's something so deep within a person that they have to switch that they have to change that. They have to choose maturity, and people just don't.
I totally agree. Yeah.
And that is such a journey to become responsible for your reality.
Mm. Yes.
You know?
Yes, exactly.
And when I think about becoming responsible about and for my own reality, I'm in the process of writing my autobiography, which I'm on like 300,000 words, and I still back 22 years or something. I still haven't caught up with myself. I see that you wrote a book called Write Your Memoir.
Yes,
and
yes.
That is such a personal and touching subject, you know, and I've
like
to talk to people. How did you see me 30 years ago? How did you feel I was 30 years ago, and et cetera, et cetera? And sometimes those things don't match with how I thought I was. I thought I was being... So I've included many of my students, you know, two or three pages of them talking about me being with me at the time. So tell us about writing your memoir. What are some of the important pieces of doing this great soul work?
Well, it is soul work. That's in the title, and that's why I wrote the book. I've been teaching memoir writing to some very wonderful writers, and I realized in every case that when they got into actually asking the difficult questions, the questions that you've just been asking, what was I like, what was really going on, whenever they got to that place, something in them broke free, broke open, certainly it broke loose, and they realized that they were engaged in reassessing their souls at a really vital level. And so many of my writers said to me, this has changed my life for the better. This has freed me. This has made me happier. And I know this to be exactly the case because I worked for many years with a prisoner in Massachusetts prisons, and he was finally released. And one of the big things we did was we started putting his life story together. And as we were going through it, he said to me, wow, you know, this is changing the way I see everything. And he had never reflected on the process that had got him into prison. I also did the same thing over a period of many years with my late father. And my late father was a man who suffered from World War II post-traumatic stress. He would wake up in the middle of the night shouting, don't shoot, and things of that sort. And it's my belief, it's his belief too, he told me it was his belief, that writing his life story, or in this case just that segment of his life, because he wrote several volumes, but he chose that one section which was later published as his memoir, he felt that that writing process had brought him to a place of greater peace. And those were words that he used and that I have used ever since. And I think we all have things we've gone through which have jangled us severely and have made us less than we could be. We can make peace with our past if we go on that soul journey of taking the time to write down our life stories. And it's important that we write them, because if we talk them out, talk is cheap. I mean, I can say something today and forget that I've said it. But when we write it, then we go back to it and say, did I really say that? Is that true? Oh, yeah, here it is. I wrote it. And that way we can question, we can go deeper, and that is the way of freedom. So for me, memoir writing really is a spiritual practice that if one continues with it, and many, many of my writers have, God bless them, that will bring you to a better place. Some of them start off saying, boy, I've got a story to tell that'll sell a million copies. And that's great. But
that's
if they sell a million copies...
Good. And we're coming up on our half-hour break now.
Yeah.
Take a deep breath. Everybody breathe out there.
You're listening to Stargazing with Star Fuentes. Star Fuentes is a master intuitive healer and spiritual teacher and has been a pioneering student of metaphysics for over 50 years. She has learned lifetimes of priceless information from her years of seeking out and living with indigenous healers and shamans around the world. Visit her website at www.starfuentes.com and then join her here every Wednesday night on Spiritual Connections Radio as she shares her knowledge with you. Once again, Star Fuentes.
We're talking to Alan Hunter at alanhunter.net, A-L-L-A-N, hunter.net. There is a book here called The Six Archetypes of Love.
Yeah.
Wow. How did you figure that out, and what do you have to say about that?
It goes like this. It's a long book, it also dovetails with my other book, Stories We Need to Know, which is about the spiritual component of so many of the books we call great literature. The Six Archetypes of Love is predicated on the fact that one of the things we are on earth to do is to learn about love. We have to learn to love the people around us at least enough to cooperate with them. Sometimes we have to learn to love people who are very difficult. They might be parents, might be children, might be bosses, but we still have to learn to love them enough. Now, this is something that had preoccupied me throughout my professional career as a professor of literature. And what I started to do was I did a grand review of all the major literature in the West that I could get my hands on, especially in English, to look at it to see if there was anything that recurred as a pattern. And what I discovered was actually really rather astonishing, and that is in all the literature of the last 3,000 years that has been called great, that people have returned to again and again and said, yes, this is important. Everything from Homer to, well, yes, Harry Potter, Harry Potter being a particularly good example, actually. All of this great literature shows us a main figure or several main figures, but usually just one main figure, who has to transition through six spiritual phases. I called these archetypes. And this is always the case. It is always in the same order, always the same six archetypes, always discussing the same problems, difficulties, spiritual challenges. It's astonishing.
Okay, I'm not going to ask you to give us the six archetypes because I want people to get the book to get it. But let's say I'm in a place in my life and I buy this book and I see that I am in one of these archetypes. Do you describe how literature has their characters get through this archetype to go on to the next, resolve this archetype? Do you get into working with how they change from being a challenge to this archetype to being an asset?
That's exactly what I do. We are all at some energetic level in an archetypal stage. And we don't know that. So sometimes we don't know that there is anything we can turn into. We don't see the road ahead, so we don't know that there is more growth to come. So, for example, sometimes people lose their job. And sometimes when they've been in the job for a long time, they become depressed. And they say, I'll never get another job. I can't do anything else. My life is over. And then they say, well, I'll just take on some task that doesn't challenge me, that I don't like, that pays the bills, something that's boring. Well, that happens to a lot of people in perilous times. Lots of people lose their jobs. But if you realize that at a moment like that, when you're thrown out of a comfortable environment where you know you can do well, you are temporarily becoming an orphan archetype, then you can say, oh, okay, so I was doing pretty well, I'm out of a job, I'm now an orphan. Now I know what I am, I know that I have to ask questions in order to start myself getting towards the pilgrim, which is the next archetype. And the pilgrim asks questions about, so what can I do with the expertise that I've got, even though I'm out of the job that I loved or had for many years? And if we allow ourselves to know that, we can make better life decisions. I've met many people who have left a job or given up a job or been fired from a job, and they've said, that's it, it's all over. But the six archetypes tell you that there are stages you can go through, and if you know that each one has one that follows it, you can say, oh, maybe I can grow towards the next stage by using the exercises and the suggestions and the examples that I put in the book. And I use examples from literature, of course. I use examples from real life. I use all kinds of questions that one can ask oneself in order to say, well, what energy am I in at the moment? And can I change that? And the answer is yes, you can. Usually, if you know you're in one energy, you can choose to change it. So many people don't change because they don't know there's anything else to change to. And so you may say, this is a handbook that says we can get unstuck. Now, particularly in terms of love, many divorces is all around us. Relationships break up. And many people who have been very empowered in their relationships, they found a place in the world, that relationship falls to pieces, and that is the prime time when they go back to being what I call the orphan archetype, and that's when we make bad decisions. If we're an orphan, unless we know we're in that space and we're vulnerable, we're quite likely to run up to the next likely-looking significant other we can find and say, ah, take care of me. You see, it's very unempowered.
Yes, that I like that idea to know the path. I like this. This also looks like something that I am going to order. You said to me the stories we need to know, which is another
yes.
one of your mini books. In literature, why do we need to know these stories? And tell me why we need to know.
There are stories we need to know because the stories that make the canon of great literature, as I said, from 3,000 years of it, those stories have hung around because enough people have said, goodness, this is really telling us about human nature. And literature has always been a guide to human nature. It's always been a way for us to travel to other realms and experience other people's lives. It's been a form of psychology before the word psychology even existed. And we can learn from that, much more than we can learn from existing psychology, I sometimes think. We can learn from these stories, but we have to be familiar with them first. We have to read them. We have to know them. Now, our modern world is full of stories. If you turn on your television, you will find my television has, I don't know how many, hundreds of channels listed, and there are many, many... there's still nothing on that really seems to feed us, or rarely seems to feed us, what we're looking for, that spiritual hunger I've been talking about. So we watch endless episodes of whatever soap or whatever cereal you like best, and sometimes we're amused, and sometimes we say, you know, isn't that crazy, isn't that funny? And yet, I have rarely to come across a serial where the characters grow significantly. They may grow a little bit, but on the whole, they can't grow because they're in a series. And if they grew too much, they wouldn't be around the next week because they wouldn't be the same people. So they have to remain the same. We like to watch programs where characters don't really change. Or change.
But they do the same thing differently. You
they
know,
do the same thing differently. How beautifully you put it.
You know, and this is where some of my students and some of my clients are stuck. And I help them work through it. They're just doing the same thing differently. And it's kind of like expecting, you know, when you wear a red shirt that doing the same thing will get you different results.
Exactly.
And the stories we need to know, people grow.
They
do. And then what happens? The story.
Well, when they grow, they begin to reassess their lives. Remember what I was just saying about memoir? And they reassess their lives in ways that sometimes make them rethink fundamentally who they are as opposed to who they thought they were or who everyone was telling them that they were. And when they get to that point, suddenly they have a chance to be truly alone and truly look inside themselves and say, so what is it I'm supposed to do? And the moment they ask that question honestly, openly, nakedly, the moment they ask that question, guess what happens? All of the fates, all of time, all of the gods, whatever it is that the structure of the story provides, everything gives them the opportunity to go back to where it was they came from and put it right. And this is something they must do alone in almost every story you can think of, whether you're talking about Odysseus in the Odyssey, whether you're talking, as I said, about Harry Potter, who has his final confrontation with Voldemort alone, whether we talk about, let's talk about one of the great stories of the West. Let's talk about the Bible. You know, what is it Jesus has to do when he is crucified? He has to face that battle on his own. And Moses, similarly, when he gets the tablets of the law, he's alone on top of the mountain. He's not with everybody, and then he has to come down the mountain and try and persuade everybody that what he knows actually is the new way of doing things, which is not easy, of course. They don't like that in the Bible.
Even if it was carved in stone, huh?
you got
to convince people, look, they carved this in stone.
That's right. Here it is, everybody.
And I worry a little bit. I worry a little bit because my great-great-grandchildren or my 14 and 15-year-olds read a paragraph on AOL or they read a sentence or three paragraphs, and they're not reading the novels. They're not reading the classics. So what happens is they end up making stories in their own life.
Yes.
And the stories and dramas that are so, so harsh or so soft from who they really are.
Yes.
So good reading, good reading is such a great healer.
You know, it is. And one of the things I notice is that our culture is a culture that reads a book and says, I've read it. Previous cultures would read books several times and really internalize what the story was saying and question it and decide whether that book really was good. But we are disposable.
But, you know, for me, I have a little different rule. I have to read a book the same book every 10 years because it means something different to me. Because I've grown, I've encountered people, experiences, and the book I read in the 50s, and the same book, same words. What I get out of it this year is so different. I have the rule of thumb, you know, every decade to read the classics, my references, the books I particularly love and stand by, because I change my interpretation of them.
Yes. Oh, how wonderful it is to hear you say that. You know, there aren't many people who do that.
it's pretty funny.
Thing.
I got the 10-year rule, but that's kind of what going back and reading a book and how often go back. And I'm a prolific reader. I read five books a week. I read five books a week, and I'm a speed reader, and I have great retention, and I can read a book in an hour and 45 minutes, and you can ask me what happened on, you know, and I'll say, oh, that's about page, you know, 80, or that's about page 120. And I have, but the whole meaning and essence of books, are they such great teachers? And even the bad books, they teach you how not to be. Bad books don't have good conversation. They don't have a good plot. Where is your life? You know, what are you setting out to do? They don't build their characters. Are you building your character? Now we have one more book to talk about, Life Passages. And this is writing exercises for your life journey. I feel that there's a lot of healing in this book. Talk to me about it.
Yes, I believe that writing is a very powerful way of healing. As I said earlier, talking can be a powerful way of healing. I've been a talk therapist for a while, but I've also found that when you get people to write about what they're thinking and feeling, then it goes deeper. Because talk is very cheap and people can deny that they've said anything. So I put together this book and its sibling, which was called The Sanity Manual, because I'd run a series of workshops for, at that point, about 10 years, which had writing exercises in them that I used as points of discussion and growth. And I still teach these workshops twice a year, usually, based on these books, and it doesn't work for everyone, of course, but I have to say that it is one of the great rewards of my life that so many people use this book and use the writing prompts and then are able to compare what they've written against the examples I give, all of which are taken from real life, and put their lives in a new context so that literally we can write a new story about our lives, but we can't write a new story until we've written the old story and questioned it. And the book is divided up into, well, life passages, because there are many life passages. You know, we may not ourselves have been divorced, but by golly, we know people who have been, and we'll meet children who are the product of divorce. So divorce is one of the passages. Falling in love is a passage. Growing old is a passage. Having children is a passage. And each of these is not just a mark of getting older. It's a mark, if we allow it, of getting deeper, of really learning and understanding at a profound level what it is that's going on in our lives. And so, yes, Life Passages is a handbook. You know, anyone who buys it should expect to also buy some paper and a pencil, or sit in front of the computer and type the results and then reread these and use the context, use the examples, use the feedback that is so plentifully supplied in order to say, how is my life compared to these? You see, one of the things about us people is that we have all these thoughts swirling around, and we sometimes don't get them into the right order until we put them down. Ask anyone who's ever had to put together a to-do list, you know. Ask anyone who's ever kept a diary, and I'm sure most people have not kept diaries, but most people keep an agenda book telling them where to be and what time to turn up for this, that, or the other meeting. These are things that when we write them down, develop a different type of reality, one that doesn't haunt us, but becomes perhaps more understandable. And so Life Passages has what I call some revolutionary and definitely road-tested exercises that will open your heart, that will open your soul, and sometimes make your hair stand on end when you realize what it is that you actually are writing about. So
years and years ago, I heard my secretary on the phone telling somebody something, and I went, wow, that's so smart. Where did you learn that? And she looked up at me and said, from you. So then I started a process. I started a process called Track Your Wisdom, and my students were all tracking down their insights when they got a good insight, except for one of my students. God bless the class rebel who tracked all my bloopers. So when you speak for, I do a 30-day a workshop, and when you speak for 8 hours a day for 30 hours, and, you wix up your words. So everybody was reading their wisdom tracks, and the students stood up and tracked all of my bloopers. And I was just amazed at when I would come out with something that didn't make sense, but it really made a lot of sense. You know what I mean? Or when I was way off on the North Pole and I should have been in Africa. there's something to tracking your wisdom journaling. Journaling is something that when I work with my cancer patients, it's something big that I do with them to journal the love, to journal the people who come in and support them. Yeah. It's really easy. Some things it's really easy to remember all the good things, and some people it's really easy to remember all the not so good
things. All the bad things. Isn't that the case? Yes.
And I got to ask you a question. I know for sure that this is happening because you already have so many books. What are you working on now?
I'm working quite energetically, actually, on the process of what I call manifesting. And manifesting has had a very bad rap since a lot of people got very excited about The Secret and then assumed that they were immediately going to get fast sports cars in their driveways the next day. And God bless those who worked on The Secret. I don't think they meant to mislead people, but it seems to me that quite a lot of people went astray. So my current project is to look at that and to reinforce the very basic fact, that is, that when we put our energy out into the universe, what we get back is who we are, not what we think we ought to be. So if we are people who say, I really need money and a fast car so I can impress my neighbors, what we're sending out is not a message that says, please send me a fast car and lots of money. What we're sending out is a message that says, I'm really insecure, and I'm worried about what my neighbors think. And the universe always answers us. And it hears.
This is a universal yes. God treats you like you treat other people, and other people treat you like you treat yourself. So if you're greedy, if you're nasty, one of the basic laws that I teach is give what you want to get. If you want new clients, share your clients who are finished or complete with you with other teachers. If you want cash, then over-tip that breakfast waitress who's probably getting the least amount of tips in a day. Give what you want to receive. And you have such a problem, not with understanding that, but with being that. They want everybody to play with them, but they won't go to anybody else's seminars. They want everybody to read their books, but they don't buy anybody else's books.
There we go. There we go. That's exactly it.
Star.
Yep.
I think manifestation is essential, and it's not about what you do and be and do and be and do and be. It's not about what you want.
Yes. Exactly.
So I am looking forward to that, and that is alanhunter.net, alanhunter.net. Now, if there was one spiritual message that you wanted the whole world to receive, what would that spiritual message be?
The spiritual message I would like everybody to receive is that when you start from a place of real gratitude, deep gratitude for everything that we are given, even the difficult things we're given, then your life changes its direction very rapidly. And it's a version, really, of what you've just been talking about. You give what you want to receive. If you want more love in your life, then go out and give love. Just as a person who is grateful will, if somebody finds your wallet and they bring it back to you, that person will be so grateful and say, here, take the folding notes. I'm just happy to get my credit cards. If what you want more of in your life is what you actually have to give. And gratitude is a great place to waken up that aspect of oneself. When you're grateful, you say, wow, look at how much I've been given. And then the next question is, so how can I give back when I've received so abundantly? And that would be the spiritual message.
God doesn't know what you received, or that you've received it, till you're grateful for it. And it's just amazing how many consumer goods we buy and take it,
yes,
and use, and take it for granted.
Yes.
Be grateful.
Yes.
You don't really get grateful till you walk into the third world country and the woman has to walk a mile a day to get three buckets of water to cook and wash
exactly.
And what I mean. So pay attention to where you are. There's so much we can do.
Yes.
So, is there anything we need to know about you? What state do you live in?
I live in Massachusetts, just outside Boston, where we've just had the most enormous amount of snow, and many people were complaining about it. But if gratitude is something that I believe in, I have to say that I was really grateful because it gave me the opportunity to go outside and shovel snow and meet all my neighbors and have the loveliest conversations. So Massachusetts, snowy Massachusetts, yep, some people
and
complain about that snow.
And is this where most classes are, or do you travel?
I teach many of my classes at Curry College, where I'm a professor, and I do some traveling. I have my own private practice. Most of what I do happens at Curry College.
Well, that's good. And we have some way to contact you on your website, correct?
Yes, there is a contact tab, so click on that, and the message will get to me, and I will answer it as soon as I possibly can.
Well, great. I mean, it's almost time to the end, and I forgot to ask our engineer, Mark, did we have a caller there, or are we just going to pass on those today?
We have one caller, but we're running out of time
caller.
Already.
Okay.
Okay, you're on.
Hi. What a beautiful conversation. Thank you so much. I'm so moved. I was going to ask if you two had any advice, because I just finished the final proofs to send to my publisher, and the book's coming out next week. And really, just
congratulations!
Thank you. And so I feel really good, but also kind of like on the edge of the cliff again. Like that shift of letting go and moving forward, and there's so much personal information, and it's very personal and from my heart. But I heard Star say do and be, and I thought, okay, well, I can just be now. Just be and don't worry about it.
Well, it's very good advice,
Now,
my information to you is you are an angel. When you wrote those experiences, all the other people who had similar experiences thought they were alone, and now they know they are not. Your book is your diamond, your process. It will shape itself. It will give you back your light 100-fold. And move you into your own future.
Oh, that is so beautiful. Thank you so
much.
Yes.
You're welcome.
That was beautifully said. Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you. And once again, thank you, AlanHunter.net, Allan, hunter.net. Thank you for being on the show tonight.
Oh, thank you so much for including me on your wonderful show and for this beautiful conversation, Star. It's just been such a privilege to be here, and it's been a great privilege to listen to your caller as well, who clearly is engaged in heartfelt and important work. And my goodness, you all are doing wonderful things. So thank you for being you.
Good night.
Good night.
On behalf of Spiritual Connections Radio, thank you for listening to Stargazing with Star Fuentes. Please join us again next week for another enlivening episode. For more information on Star's classes or services, visit her website at www.starfuentes.com or call the office at 501-609-0660. That's 501-609-0660.